You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Colorado Business Digest, narrated by Michael Hesser, with sources including ColoradoBiz.com, the Colorado Business Journal, Colorado Springs Business Journal, and Denver7.com. Our first article is titled, IRS says it has recovered $4.7 billion from back taxes and crime. The agency braces for cuts with Trump and GOP in power. Dated December 12, 2024. IRS leadership on Thursday announced that the agency has recovered $4.7 billion in back taxes and proceeds from a variety of crimes since the nation's tax collector received a massive glut of funding through Democrats' flagship tax, climate, and health law in 2022. The announcement comes under the backdrop of a promised reckoning from Republicans who will hold a majority over both chambers of the next Congress and have long called for rescinding the tens of billions of dollars in funding provided to the agency by Democrats. IRS leadership, meanwhile, is hoping to justify saving the funding the agency already has. On a call with reporters to preview the announcement, IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel said improvements made to the agency during his term will help the incoming administration and new Republican-majority Congress achieve its goals of administering an extension of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Republicans plan to renew some $4 trillion in expiring GOP tax cuts, a signature domestic achievement of Trump's first term, and an issue that may define his return to the White House. We know there are serious discussions about a major tax bill coming out of the next Congress, Werfel said. And with the improvements we've made since I've been here, I'm quite confident the IRS will be well positioned to deliver on whatever new tax law that Congress passes. Tax collections announced Thursday include $1.3 billion from high-income taxpayers who did not pay overdue tax debts, $2.9 billion related to IRS criminal investigation work into crimes like drug trafficking and terrorist financing, and $475 million in proceeds from criminal and civil cases that came from whistleblower information. The IRS also announced Thursday that it has collected $292 million from more than 28,000 high-income non-filers who have not filed taxes since 2017, an increase of $120 million since September. Despite its gains, the future of the agency's funding is in limbo. The IRS originally received an $80 billion infusion of funds under the Inflation Reduction Act through the 2023 debt ceiling, and budget cuts deal between Republicans and the White House resulted in $1.4 billion, rescinded from the agency and a separate agreement to take $20 billion from the IRS over the next 2 years and divert those funds to other non-defense programs. In November, U.S. Treasury officials called on Congress to unlock $20 billion in IRS enforcement money that is tied up in legislative language that has effectively rendered the money frozen. The $20 billion in question is separate from another $20 billion rescinded from the agency last year. However, the legislative mechanism keeping the government afloat inadvertently duplicated the one-time cut. Treasury officials warn of dire consequences if the funding is effectively rescinded through inaction. Trump last week announced plans to nominate former Missouri Congressman Billy Long, who worked as an auctioneer before serving 6 terms in the House of Representatives, to serve as the next commissioner of the IRS. Democrats, like Senator Ron Wyden, have called Long's nomination a bizarre choice since Long jumped into the scam-plagued industry involving the employee retention tax credit. Trump said on his social media site that taxpayers and the wonderful employees of the IRS will love having Billy at the helm. Werfel's term is set to end in 2027, and he has not indicated whether he plans to step down from his role before Trump's inauguration. Trump is permitted to fire Werfel under the law. Our next article is titled, Albertsons Sues Kroger for Failing to Win Approval of Their Proposed Supermarket Merger. breakup comes a day after judges halted the deal in separate court cases. Dated December 11, 2024, by Deanne Durbin. Kroger and Albertsons' plan for the largest U.S. supermarket merger in history crumbled Wednesday, with Albertsons pulling out of the $24.6 billion deal and the two companies accusing each other of not doing enough to push their proposed alliance through. Albertsons said it had filed a lawsuit against Kroger, seeking a $600 million termination fee, as well as billions of dollars in legal fees and lost shareholder value. Kroger said the claims were baseless and that Albertsons was not entitled to the fee. After reviewing options, the company determined it is no longer in its best interest to pursue the merger, Kroger said in a statement Wednesday. The bitter breakup came the day after two judges halted the proposed merger in separate court cases. U.S. District Court Judge Adrian Nelson in Oregon issued a preliminary injunction Tuesday blocking the merger until an in-house judge at the Federal Trade Commission could consider the matter. An hour later, Superior Court Judge Marshall Ferguson in Seattle issued a permanent injunction barring the merger. Ferguson ruled that combining Albertsons and Kroger would lessen competition and violate consumer protection laws. The companies could have appealed the rulings or proceeded to the in-house FTC hearings. Albertsons decided to pull out of the deal instead, surprising some industry experts. "I'm in a state of professional and commercial shock that they would take this scorched-earth approach," said Bert Flickinger, a longtime analyst and owner of retail consulting firm Strategic Resource Group. "The logical thing would have been for Albertsons to let the decision sink in for a day and then meet and see what could be done, but the lawsuit seems to make that a moot issue." In Colorado, which also sued to block the merger, Attorney General Phil Weiser said Tuesday that he still was awaiting a decision from a state judge. In that case, Colorado also was challenging an allegedly illegal no-poach agreement Kroger and Albertsons made during a 2022 strike. Albertsons is unlikely to find another merger partner because it has a significant debt and underperforming stores in most of its markets. Flickinger said consumers will still feel the most immediate impact of the deal's demise, since Albertsons charges 12 to 14% more than Kroger and other grocery rivals. "They had so much debt they had to pay off. It's reflected in their pricing and promotional structure," Flickinger said. Albertsons CEO Vivek Sankaran testified during the federal hearing in September that his company might consider structural options, like laying off employees, closing stores, and exiting certain markets if the merger with Kroger didn't go through. "I would have to consider that," he said. "It's a dramatically different picture with a merger than without it." But in a statement Wednesday, Sankaran said Albertsons would start this next chapter in strong financial condition with a track record of positive business performance. In the company's most recent quarter, Albertsons' revenue rose 1% to $18.5 billion, and it reported $7.9 billion in debt. Kroger said it would also move forward in a strong financial position, with revenue down slightly to $33.6 billion in its most recent quarter. The company announced a $7.5 billion share buyback program Wednesday after a two-year pause. Kroger and Albertsons first proposed the merger in 2022. They argued that combining would help them better compete with big retailers like Walmart, Costco, and Amazon, which are gaining an increasing share of the U.S. grocery sales. Together, Kroger and Albertsons would control around 13% of the U.S. grocery market. Walmart controls around 22%. Under the merger agreement, Kroger and Albertsons, who compete in 22 states, agreed to sell 579 stores in places where their locations overlapped to C&S Wholesale Grocers, a New Hampshire-based supplier to independent supermarkets that also owns the Grand Union and Piggly Wiggly store brands. But the Federal Trade Commission and two states, Washington and Colorado, sued to block the merger earlier this year, saying it would raise prices and lower workers' wages by eliminating competition. It also said the divestiture plan was inadequate and that C&S was ill-equipped to take on so many stores. On Wednesday, Albertson said that Kroger failed to exercise best efforts and to take any and all actions to secure regulatory approval of the company's agreed merger transaction. Albertson said Kroger refused to divest the assets necessary for antitrust approval, ignored regulators' feedback, and rejected divestiture buyers that would have been stronger than CNS. Kroger's self-serving conduct, taken at the expense of Albertsons and the agreed transaction, has harmed Albertsons shareholders, associates, and consumers, said Tom Moriarty, Albertsons general counsel, in a statement. Kroger said that it disagrees with Albertsons in the strongest possible terms. It said early Wednesday that Albertsons was responsible for repeated intentional material breaches and interference throughout the merger process. Kroger, based in Cincinnati, operates 2,800 stores in 35 states, including brands like Ralph's, Smith's, and Harris Teeter. Albertsons, based in Idaho, operates 2,273 stores in 34 states, including brands like Safeway, Jewel Osco, and Shaw's. Together, the companies employ around 710,000 people. Kroger sued the FTC in August in federal court in Ohio, claiming that the federal agency's in-house administrative hearings were unlawful because the FTC was also able to challenge the merger in federal court in Oregon. In paperwork filed Wednesday, the FTC said it expected to update the court on its next steps in that case by December 17. Shares of Albertsons fell 1.5% Wednesday, while Kroger's stock was up 1%. Our next article is titled, Economists Forecast Mortgage Rates to Stay Above 6% Next Year. Historical average is 7% going back to 1971. Dated December 15, 2024. Home shoppers hoping for more attractive mortgage rates next year may be disappointed. That's the takeaway from several economists' 2025 housing forecasts, most recently over the past couple of weeks. Most of the eight forecasts call for the average rate on a 30-year mortgage to remain above 6% next year, with some including an upper range as high as 6.8%. That range would be largely in line with where rates have hovered this year. The average rate has gone as low as 6.08% in September, a two-year low, and as high as 7.22% in May, according to mortgage buyer Freddie Mac. The average rate was 6.6% this week. Even by the end of next year, it's hard to see sub-6% mortgage rates, said Mark Fleming, chief economist at First American, which predicts the average rate on a 30-year mortgage will range between 6% and 6.5% next year. The biggest wild card for mortgage rates next year is whether President-elect Donald Trump's major policy initiatives will end up driving inflation and the national debt higher, which could keep mortgage rates elevated. That's because what happens with inflation, the U.S. deficit, and the economy can influence moves in the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield, which lenders use as a guide to price home loans. Trump says he wants to impose tariffs on foreign goods, lower tax rates, and lighten regulations, policies that could rev up the economy, but also fuel inflation and increase U.S. government debt. Economists at Redfin project that the average rate on a 30-year mortgage will hover around 6.8% next year, citing expectations that Trump's proposed tax cuts would increase the U.S. deficit, and his tariff plan could stoke inflation, ultimately pushing mortgage rates higher. However, mortgage rates could drop to the low 6% range if the economy weakens or if plans for tariffs and tax cuts are dialed back, according to the forecast. A couple of forecasts are more optimistic about how low the average rate on a 30-year mortgage will go in 2025. Fitch Ratings sees it ranging from 5.8 to 6.4%, while TD Economics predicts the average rate will drop to 5.8% by the end of the year. The average rate is still below its historical average of 7% going back to 1971. But that's little consolation to home shoppers now, because over the last 10 years, home prices have risen much more quickly than incomes. So it's kind of having this double whammy on affordability that someone 30 years ago with a 6% rate wasn't having to deal with, said Lisa Sturtevant, chief economist at Bright MLS. Rates in the 6% range would mean most homeowners with a mortgage would have to take on a higher rate than they currently have if they elected to sell their home and finance another. More than 4 in 5 homeowners with a mortgage have an existing rate below 6%, according to Realtor.com. Economists see some bright spots for homebuyers next year, those who can afford to buy regardless of where rates are, or who can bypass them altogether by tapping into home equity gains, should benefit from a continued increase in homes for sale and a modest pace of home price growth. Our next article is titled, OpenAI's Legal Battle with Elon Musk Reveals Internal Turmoil Over Avoiding AI Dictatorship, dated December 15, 2024. A 7-year rivalry between tech leaders Elon Musk and Sam Altman over who should run OpenAI and prevent an artificial intelligence dictatorship is now heading to a federal judge as Musk seeks to halt the ChatGPT maker's ongoing shift into a for-profit company. Musk, an early OpenAI investor and board member, sued the artificial intelligence company earlier this year, alleging it had betrayed its founding aims as a nonprofit research lab benefiting the public good rather than pursuing profits. Musk has since escalated the dispute, adding new claims and asking for a court order that would stop OpenAI's plans to convert itself into a for-profit business more fully. The world's richest man, whose companies include Tesla, SpaceX, and social media platform X, last year started his own rival AI company, xAI. Musk says it faces unfair competition from OpenAI and its close business partner Microsoft, which has supplied the huge computing resources needed to build AI systems such as ChatGPT. OpenAI and Microsoft together, exploiting Musk's donations so they can build a for-profit monopoly, one now specifically targeting xAI, is just too much, says Musk's filing that alleges the companies are violating the terms of Musk's foundational contributions to the charity. OpenAI filed a response Friday opposing Musk's requested order, saying it would debilitate OpenAI's business and mission to the advantage of Musk and his own AI company, and is based on far-fetched legal claims. A hearing is set for January before U.S. District Judge Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers in Oakland, California. At the heart of the dispute is a 2017 internal power struggle at the fledgling startup that led to Altman becoming OpenAI's CEO. Musk also sought to be CEO, and in an email outlined a plan where he would unequivocally have control of the company, but said that would be temporary. He grew frustrated after two other OpenAI co-founders said he would hold too much power as a major stakeholder and chief executive. The startup succeeded in its goal to achieve better-than-human AI, known as Artificial General Intelligence, or AGI. Musk has long voiced concerns about how advanced forms of AI could threaten humanity. The current structure provides you with a path where you end up with unilateral absolute control over AGI, said a 2017 email to Musk from co-founders Ayla Sutskever and Greg Brockman. You stated that you don't want to control the final AGI, but during this negotiation, you've shown us that absolute control is extremely important to you. In the same email, titled Honest Thoughts, Sutskever and Brockman also voiced concerns about Altman's desire to be CEO and whether he was motivated by political goals. Altman eventually succeeded in becoming CEO and has remained so, except for a period last year when he was fired and then reinstated days later after the board that ousted him was replaced. OpenAI published the messages Friday in a blog post meant to show its side of the story, particularly Musk's early support for the idea of making OpenAI a for-profit business so it could raise money for the hardware and computer power that AI needs. It was Musk, through his wealth manager Jared Bershall, who first registered Open Artificial Intelligence Technologies, Inc., a public benefit corporation, in September 2017. Then came the Honest Thoughts email that Musk described as the final straw. "Either go do something on your own or continue with OpenAI as a nonprofit," Musk wrote back. OpenAI said Musk later proposed merging the startup into Tesla before resigning as the co-chair of OpenAI's board in early 2018. Musk didn't respond to email requests for comments sent to his companies Friday. Asked about his frayed relationship with Musk at a New York Times conference last week, Altman said he felt tremendously sad, but also characterized Musk's legal fight as one about business competition. "He's a competitor, and we're doing well," Altman said. He also said at the conference that he is not that worried about the Tesla's CEO's influence with President-elect Donald Trump. OpenAI said Friday that Altman plans to make a $1 million personal donation to Trump's inauguration fund, joining a number of tech companies and executives who are working to improve their relationships with the incoming administration. Our next article is titled, "Peak Energy Sodium Ion Battery Company Opens Engineering Branch in Broomfield. New Sodium Ion Battery Technology Looks to 2027 Production." A new advance in grid-scale battery storage is coming to Colorado. Peak Energy, developer of a sodium-ion battery, is establishing an advanced battery cell engineering center in Broomfield that will be focused on developing proprietary U.S.-produced batteries for use in grid storage systems in the short term. The company may expand into the home storage and even auto battery markets down the road. The engineering center is expected to enable the scaling of domestic battery cell manufacturing by 2027 using U.S.-based supply chains. "We are thrilled to see Peak Energy expand in Colorado, creating good-paying jobs and joining us on the path to 100% renewable energy by 2040, said Governor Jared Polis in a news release from the Colorado Office of Economic Development and International Trade. "Colorado is advancing the clean energy economy, and together with companies like Peak Energy, we can harness the power of the sun for a brighter future." The basic technology of sodium ion battery is simple and uses commonly available materials such as sodium bicarbonate, hard carbon, aluminum, and phosphoric acid. All the key materials are available domestically, which assures that the international geopolitics can't disrupt supply chains, which are now affecting rare earth materials supplied by China. In response to President-elect Donald Trump's statements about imposing tariffs on Chinese goods, China blocked the export of rare earth minerals necessary for manufacturing things like high-power magnets for electric motors and materials required for integrated circuit boards. According to researcher Linda Zhao at the Shenyang University of Technology, the world's lithium reserves could be exhausted in only 28 years without substantial recycling. In a 2023 published paper, Zhao said that sodium-based batteries hold significant promise for large-scale energy storage and grid development based mostly on its abundance in the Earth's crust. Peak Energy CEO Landon Mossberg told the Denver Gazette that the domestic supply of manufacturing materials is advantageous over lithium-ion batteries because the U.S. has extensive reserves of sodium bicarbonate, also known as trona, with many uses, including baking soda for cooking. The largest source of trona in the world is in Wyoming. The Wyoming Mining Association said, "The U.S. Geological Survey in 1997 estimated the total reserve of trona to be 127 billion tons, but only 40 billion tons are recoverable. At the current operation rate, Wyoming's trona reserves will last 2,350 years. According to the Wyoming Geological Survey, Wyoming mines have produced over 633.2 million tons of trona since 1949. Mossberg said the Broomfield facility is a testing and engineering facility that will eventually employ 25 to 40 people. If Peak decides to build a battery manufacturing plant in Colorado, it could create hundreds to thousands of new jobs. Peak Energy operates out of California during its development phase, but is considering moving manufacturing to Colorado once the research and development justifies building a manufacturing facility. "We're really excited to be here. I think it's been great working with Colorado through this process," said Mossberg. "Governor Polis has been really supportive, and I think down the road our plan is to build a battery factory, and I think Colorado is definitely going to be one of the places we're looking at." Peak Energy has more than 60 employees, 13 of whom are in Colorado. Peak Energy is a welcome partner in Colorado's growing renewable energy and battery ecosystem. "When companies like Peak Energy choose Colorado for expansion, we have the power to develop critical renewable energy technologies, create new good-paying jobs, and secure our energy future," said OEDIT Executive Director Eve Lieberman in the release. Our next article is titled, "Finance is a Mess? Your Shopping Mentality Might Be the Problem," dated December 2, 2024. When you shop, do you favor quantity or quality? Your approach to spending has big implications for your overall financial health, according to a new study forthcoming in the Journal of Consumer Research. It finds that consumers generally fall into two camps: those who tend to invest in fewer high-quality items, and those who buy a larger amount of cheaper goods. Your disposition toward quality or quantity can predict a host of financial outcomes, including your debt and savings levels. Your preference for quality or quantity significantly influences not just what you buy, but how well you manage your finances overall, said Rodrigo Diaz, lead author of the study and assistant professor of marketing at the Leeds School of Business. Encompassing more than 24,000 participants and 32 studies, the research found that shoppers who prioritize quantity tend to spend more, borrow more, and accumulate more debt than those who favor quality. "Consumers who lean toward quantity often find themselves spending more and saving less," Diaz said. "One reason for that is expense tracking. The more you track your spending, the less you spend," Diaz said. "Higher quantity people are always buying and not as motivated to keep track of their purchases, and if they don't track, they end up spending more." The research indicates that those who consistently prefer quality across their purchases tend to manage their finances better than their quantity-focused consumers. These consumers spend less, in part, because they tend to consider alternative ways of spending their money, along with potential benefits and drawbacks, what's called opportunity cost, more so than quantity-focused shoppers. "Consumers who prioritize quantity take on more debt to support their higher spending," Diaz noted. The researchers also found those who prefer quantity showed a concerning pattern of recurring debt accumulation over time. "A worrisome finding is that quantity-focused consumers allocate less money toward paying off their debt," Diaz said. "As a result, over time, they are saddled with greater debt, even in categories for which initial borrowing was the same. An example of this pattern is the association with student loan debt. By analyzing a data set with a representative sample of over 10,000 U.S. consumers, the researchers found that those who preferred quantity owed about $43,000 in their student loans, while those who preferred quality owed about $38,000. This finding held even after the researchers accounted for a host of factors that may affect consumers' debt levels, such as income, age, education, and marital status. "Many consumers struggle with a self-image that doesn't align with their spending habits. People often think, I only buy quality clothes, yet they may purchase cheaper household items without realizing it. This discrepancy between how they rationalize their choices and what they actually buy is striking," Diaz said. The researchers found that people generally do not exhibit a mix of the two shopping habits. Diaz pointed out a fascinating consistency in the study. "If you look at the data, it becomes clear quality people tend to prefer quality across the board, and quantity people do the same. Over time, consumers don't tend to change their preferences," he added. And while many consumers aspire to favor quality, some openly admit to preferring quantity. About 25% to 30% of people tend to prefer quantity over quality, he said. The research also uncovered some troubling personality traits linked to a preference for quantity. We found that compulsive buying, shopping to cope with negative feelings, is associated with a preference for quantity over quality. Materialistic consumers also prioritize quantity, equating possessions with their self-worth. In addition, the research established a significant connection between quality-quantity preferences and actual spending behavior. Those who preferred quantity spent an average of $89 in a shopping stimulation, compared with $79 for those who favored quality. This shows that preference directly translates into spending. The more you lean toward quantity, the more you're likely to overspend, Rodrigo noted. Since the study finds that consumers generally don't change when it comes to spending patterns, it's important to be self-aware, since understanding your own spending habits can lead to smarter financial choices, Diaz said. The research developed a quantity-quality trade-off scale, which can help assess their spending tendencies. Based on the study's findings, here are some tips for consumers to take control of their finances. 1. Reflect on your purchases. Do you typically buy fewer, higher quality items, or do you gravitate toward deals and bulk purchases? Recognizing your natural inclination can help you make more conscious spending choices. In hindsight, a lot of people realize that they're just buying stuff and not getting a lot of joy out of it, Diaz said. 2, understand your emotional triggers. Recognize how emotional satisfaction from purchases can lead to impulsive buying and financial strain. 3, consider the long-term costs. While buying in bulk or opting for cheaper alternatives might seem appealing in the moment, it could lead to greater spending in the long run. Higher quality items often last longer, potentially saving you money over time. 4, shop savvy. Be critical of promotions. If you prefer quality, don't let quantity discounts sway your decisions unless it aligns with your values. Recognizing these emotional connections can help you make smarter choices, Diaz said. Our next article is titled, Should You Trust Five-Star Reviews? Dated November 15, 2024. There's no understating the influence of online reviews on consumers' purchase decisions. 9 out of 10 say they consider reviews before making a purchase, and 45% simply won't purchase a product if it has no reviews available, according to recent research from consumer research firm Power Reviews. But there are limitations to relying solely on user ratings and online reviews to evaluate product quality, according to Nicholas Reinholds, who researches consumer behavior, including financial decision-making, product and price search. Reinholds sat down with CU Boulder today to discuss how consumer expectations and other factors affect ratings and how biases in rating systems can lead to inaccurate assessments and potentially bad purchases. If you go on Amazon and buy a $500 pair of headphones, and if there are any problems at all, you give it 1 star. You say, I can't believe I paid $500 for a pair of headphones, and there is a crackle. Unacceptable, right? Whereas if you paid $5 for the headphones, you give it 5 stars because they work. That expectation should influence ratings does make sense. You can't have a 5-point scale that encompasses the entire spectrum of human experience, right? Ratings are relative to the expectations you have going into the product purchase. There are multiple issues with that, and one of them is that when people are looking at products, they don't account for the fact that ratings reflect expectations. With the research on Airbnb ratings, the point that is trying to be made is that it's totally fine and reasonable that people would give ratings that reflect their expectations. But it's problematic if future consumers don't recognize the role of these expectations and adjust for them accordingly. There should be a mantra. When you're on Amazon, more stars don't mean better. I don't think star ratings are useless, because they can, particularly coupled with text reviews, identify truly problematic things, like if something gets a terrible rating. I think if you're using ratings to compare, say, a product that looks better, but it's only 4.7 stars, whereas another similar product maybe looks a little bit worse, but it's 4.9 stars. Those are the types of situations where I think we really need to exert caution for a variety of reasons instead of just blindly following the ratings. Said author Nicholas Reinholtz, assistant professor of marketing in the Leeds School of Business. If we rate experiences, it's really hard to disentangle contextual influences from intrinsic ones. For example, we looked at ratings for winter jackets on REI and merged those ratings with weather data. It turns out that people rate winter jackets better on warmer days and worse on colder days. The reason we think that happens is that you go outside on a super cold day and you're cold. And when you rate the jacket you're wearing, you're like, well, I'm cold, so this jacket must not be that great. Whereas you go out on a warm day and the jacket feels great, right? It's perfect. You're totally warm. The thing that surprises me most is how uncritically people accept reviews as a measure of quality. We had a thought experiment related to headphones. We asked study participants to imagine they are looking at two pairs of headphones online. One is a $500 pair of headphones and has a 4.6 rating. The other is a $5 pair of headphones with a 4.8 rating. We asked, which of these two pairs of headphones do you think are higher quality? We were convinced that everyone would point to the $500 pair. It turns out that only about 50% did. The other half endorsed the idea that the $5 headphones were higher quality. We always like to think of ourselves as more savvy. That's a powerful draw of reviews, and I still catch myself looking at them and being like, I think I'll like it, but you know, it's a 4.7. Maybe there's something wrong with it. I was buying carabiners the other day, and I found myself looking for higher-rated carabiners, 4.7 versus 4.9. And then I had to be like, come on, don't do this. It's a tough world out there for a consumer, and you don't have many people whose incentives are aligned with yours. These days, I find myself gravitating more and more to brands, which is something I didn't do as a younger person, because I feel like you can build trust in brand quality, unlike picking a product on Amazon whose name you've never heard of and sounds like alphabet soup. Our next article is titled, Colorado Gas Station Owner Fears Proposed Buc-ee's Location Would Threaten Small Business, quote, economic cannibalism, unquote. Many residents have voiced their opinion on a proposed Buc-ee's for Palmer Lake, but how do business owners feel? Dated December 13, 2024, by Tony Keith. The owner of a Sinclair gas station in Monument shared her opinion with KOAA on the proposed Palmer Lake Buc-ee's just before a key meeting on the project. The gas station and repair shop are located along Highway 105, just east of I-25, one exit south of the proposed Buc-ee's location. It stands out with an iconic green Sinclair dinosaur statue facing toward the highway. I just think that Buc-ee's is economically cannibalism, Chandra Sweet stated soon after she ended her shift Wednesday. Basically, I feel if they were on the next off-ramp, they would take our bread and butter, which is the traffic that drives through during the summertime or during the holidays. Sweet took over the operation as a Sinclair dealer site in 2010 from her father. She employs fewer than 10 people, who she says mostly grew up in the area, graduating from Lewis Palmer and Palmer Ridge High Schools. As an independent dealer site, we pay more per gallon for our petrol than stores that have more buying power. So we can't compete with our price per gallon, Sweet explained. I feel like everyone says they want to keep things American and small town and back to basics, and a Buc-ee's is not that. KOAA spoke with customers at Sweet Station as they rolled in Wednesday afternoon. 10 people said they opposed the Buc-ee's, 4 said they supported it, and 1 said he was indifferent. However, those who opposed it didn't want their names and faces shared publicly because of the large public outcry. KOAA viewers on Facebook are mixed about the possibility of a Buc-ee's coming to northern El Paso County. Those who support it say the community should welcome the tax revenue the travel stop could bring to the town. The Texas-based Buc-ee's has a strong following across the country, with many throwing their support behind the Johnstown location north of Denver that was opened earlier this year. Others are behind the new jobs that would be coming to the area. For Sweet, her concern goes beyond just her own business. "It's going to affect a bunch of smaller, locally owned businesses," Sweet added. "Luckily, we have the repair shop, but the 7-Eleven doesn't." The 7-Eleven Sweet spoke of is located on the west side of I-25, across from Sweet's business. KOAA spoke to several business owners in the Tri-Lakes area, with all of them against the idea of a Buc-ee's in their community. If you are a local business owner in the area who is in support of the Buc-ee's and willing to talk on camera, please email tony.keith@koaa.com. The proposed site for Buc-ee's is currently in El Paso County, outside of the Palmer Lake town limits. Right now, Buc-ee's is hoping land will be annexed into Palmer Lake. The Palmer Lake Board of Trustees is scheduled to meet Thursday night at 6 to go over preliminary approval for the flagpole annexation request. The business item the board will consider is eligibility of the annexation, not voting for or against the annexation, a post on the Palmer Lake website reads. Whether to annex property to the town of Palmer Lake is a decision that has to be made by the Board of Trustees of Palmer Lake, who are elected by the electors of Palmer Lake. Our next article is titled, Clear Creek County Announces Layoffs, Business Hour Changes. County leaders say long-term budget constraints make the changes necessary. Dated December 13, 2024 by Brandon Richard. Clear Creek County announced it is laying off some employees due to ongoing budget constraints. The county said it was laying off 4 employees and eliminating 4 other unfilled positions. Clear Creek County Commissioner George Marlin said he and his colleagues did everything they could to avoid doing what they ultimately had to do. "We've looked at every other option, everything we can do to increase the efficiency of our operation," Marlin said. "We've spent years and years doing everything we can to avoid layoffs and looking under every rock. The employees being laid off in different county offices and are not in direct emergency service roles. In addition, starting on January 2nd, administrative planning and non-emergency county employees will shift to a 32-hour work week. Because of the shorter work week, many county offices will have shorter service hours. Most will now be open from 7:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Thursday. Aside from declining sales and property tax, which many communities are dealing with, Marlin said the county's financial struggles go back to 2015, when the local mine started producing less. "That's really where we get our revenue from. We're getting half of the property tax revenue this year than 2015, and that's a $9 million loss," Marlin said. The county said it continues to address long-term structural challenges. Over the years, the county has worked to reduce staff through attrition and streamline non-essential services to ensure fiscal responsibility while maintaining critical operations. Since 2015, the county has made significant progress, reducing its workforce from 228 full-time equivalents to 193 as of today. These measures reflect the county's ongoing commitment to financial sustainability and effective governance and service to the community, the county's press release said. Marlin hopes members of the public will offer their own ideas. "What we want to hear is, what are the ideas that you have? What are the services that you like? What are the services that you think you can live without? And what's your interest in paying more taxes, whether that's sales tax or property tax or other options," Marlin said. The sheriff's office, EMS, transit, and the transfer station will keep their normal operating hours. "There's two things that I hope people take away from this. One is the government's still open, and when you call 911, someone's going to show up and save your life or deal with a burglary," Marlin said. Public Works will continue operating as usual, but the county said the division's office hours will be shortened to 7:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Thursday. The employees who are being laid off will be paid through the end of the year and are being offered severance packages. Our next article is titled, Denver Tool Library Builds Community Through Shared Resources and Skills, dated December 13, 2024. Nestled in crowded buildings along Santa Fe Avenue, the Denver Tool Library offers a twist on the traditional concept of a library. Instead of books, library members can check out a wide range of tools for their home improvement projects. Founded in 2015 by Sarah Steiner, the library has grown from humble beginnings. "When we first started, we had a secret back entrance in the alley," said Steiner with a laugh. "We couldn't afford to rent the whole building." Today, it holds over 5,000 tools, from table saws to gardening equipment, all available with a $150 annual membership fee. The scope of the library has expanded, too. It now houses workshop space for classes. Those spaces can also be rented out by its members. Chris Holy, a community workshop monitor and wood-turning instructor for the library, believes that hands-on instruction is the best way to learn hand-on skills. "Just like anything these days, you could learn that just from YouTube," Holy explained. "But it's a lot easier with an experienced instructor to guide you through all the pitfalls." Despite the challenges faced by similar workshops in the area, the Denver Tool Library thrives by fostering a collaborative atmosphere and by expanding at a rate that works for them. "The kind of secret sauce to this place is just starting small, expanding as you go, and responding to the demands of the membership," said Holy. Steiner believes that the $150 membership fee can pay for itself almost immediately, especially if a product calls for one big rental item. "We hear from people a lot that we've saved them thousands of dollars in tool rentals over a year of working on their first home," Steiner said. "Yet the main reason for the success of the library is the people who participate. There's a spirit of sharing and collaboration, with members often consulting each other for the best ways to complete their projects." "It's really beloved in the community," Holy said. "I think we also have a really personal touch that people appreciate. I'm able to give people a lot of individual attention in the open shop hours, really help them out, and think them through their projects. I think that shows and kind of keeps the people coming back." "This space is like if you started a fort in your backyard," said Steiner. "Then it turned into something that the whole community just really loved and appreciated and participated in. It always surprises me. It's always got something interesting to try to figure out. It's a fun place to be, and I'm really lucky to be part of it." Our next article is titled, Denver Business Owners, City Leaders Thrilled About Plans to Revamp Downtown Over the Next Decade, dated December 13, 2024. This week, the Denver City Council approved the Denver Downtown Development Authority's amended plan that outlines how millions of dollars will be spent to revamp the city's downtown over the next decade. Colorado law allows municipalities, through downtown development authorities, to collect a portion of property and sales tax in central business districts to finance projects that spur economic development. There are more than 20 DDAs in communities across Colorado. The Denver Downtown Development Authority helped transform Union Station and revitalize the surrounding area. In November, more than 77% of select Denver voters voted yes on ballot issue 6A, which expanded the DDDA's boundaries to include more of downtown. It also allowed the city to take on $570 million in debt on behalf of the DDDA to use on projects to revitalize the area without increasing taxes. The total repayment cost will be up to $847 million. On Monday, the City Council approved the DDDA's amended plan of development, paving the way for the Development Authority to begin its revamp. "I think it'll really transition this place," said Derek Friedman, who owns Sports Fan on the 16th Street Mall. Friedman has owned his business since 2004. He told Denver 7 that some of the toughest and most troubling times have come from the pandemic. "It's been 4 years that have been really, really tough," Friedman said. "So to hear about a big investment that is coming that, I think, is really going to help transform everything along 16th Street and really the whole downtown corridor, we're super excited about it." Denver Mayor Mike Johnston and City Council Member Chris Hines share in that excitement for what is to come. This will be the largest investment in downtown in Denver's history, all done without raising taxes, said Mayor Johnston. It uses this tax increment finance that we have in downtown, but what it's going to be used for is making downtown a wonderful place to work, to live, to play. We're going to have good stuff everywhere, including marquee signature places where all those folks can get out of their neighborhood and come to the city center, which is all in the middle, and see some amazing things, Hines said. Millions of dollars will go toward doing things like adding art installations throughout downtown, improving public parks and spaces, and even turning empty commercial office buildings into residential buildings. It's something Johnston and Hines said could make a world of a difference in downtown. We've already heard from a lot of folks who are very excited about taking empty buildings and putting them to better use, reviving some old spaces and filling vacant retail spots with exciting new retailers people can come to and see and shop, Johnston said. We see this as a defining opportunity for Denver. Friedman agrees. There was a dramatic drop in our business, just from the people who would be downtown naturally, he said. If they're not downtown and they're at home, then all of that activity moves somewhere else. Super excited about the fact that it'll be here and stay here. Project applications for how exactly the money will be spent are expected to open in January. Our next article is titled, Volunteers Say It Takes a Village to Bring Together Christmas Store Charity Event in Parker. Volunteers from Advent Health Parker and New Day Adventist Church work all year to find the perfect presents to give away for free at the Christmas store. Dated December 11, 2024. For the past 13 years, Advent Health Parker and New Day Adventist Church in Parker have teamed up to provide free gifts to families in need during their four-day Christmas store charity event. Each year, Parker schools identify children who could use help putting presents under the Christmas tree and invite them to shop at the Christmas store at Adventist Health Parker Hospital. Visiting kids are allowed one gift for themselves, but are encouraged to pick multiple gifts for each member of their immediate family. That is a really special thing, to be able to not just receive, but to have the joy of giving to others. And you see some kids come to these tables, and they will walk around, and they're really thinking, what would my brother or sister really want? Said Shauna Sadjak, the Director of Community Outreach at New Day Adventist Church in Parker. This year, volunteers shopped for enough gifts to support 200 families. Throughout the year, we are shopping for gifts. 95% of the gifts are purchased. About 5% are donated. We are just looking for good deals, going through the clearance bins, looking for things that we think the kids would like, said Sajak. Sajak oversees 200 volunteers, with work beginning in January. When it's all said and done, 3,000 gifts will be bought, organized, and given away. Volunteers transform the inside of a hospital conference room into a winter wonderland with decorations and tables full of presents. The kids know they'll be entering the hospital, so they're a little nervous to begin with. And when they come down the hall and start to see the decorations, you can just see their eyes get big, said Pastor Lisa Cardinal, the lead pastor at New Day Adventist Church. The work is tedious, but these volunteers are happy to spend their time ensuring a special holiday for their neighbors. I usually don't see volunteers leaving without a smile either, said Sajak. In its 13 years, the Christmas Store event has seen a sharp rise in the number of families they support. From one year to the next, a school might say, you know, this year we need 7 invitations, and the very next year they ask for 28 invitations, said Cardinal. But with the help of volunteers and donations, the group has said yes to every request. That saying, it takes a village, that is absolutely true. It takes a village all throughout the year to pull this off, said Sajak. If you'd like to donate to next year's funds, you can visit the New Day Adventist Church website. Thank you for listening to Colorado Business Digest, narrated by Michael Hesser. Have a wonderful holiday season.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-303-303. 786-7777.